everybody. We're going to be talking today about the Spanish-American War. I was telling someone this afternoon I was going to be lecturing on this subject, and the person thought I was talking about the Spanish Civil War. So I just want to make sure there's no confusion here. We're not talking about the war that began in 1936 between the Spanish Republicans and Spanish Nationalists. We're talking about the war in which the United States went to war with Spain over conditions in Cuba, just to make sure everybody knows what the subject is. Now, there's a problem in talking about Spanish-American War that isn't present for the other wars in this course. They were first lecture I spoke last week on the war between the states. Well, that was the most important war of the 19th century, so it's clear why we're talking about that, or what we're going to be talking about: World War I, World War II. Obviously, those are extraordinarily important wars, but we might wonder, why are we talking about the Spanish-American War at all? Not there isn't sufficient material for a lecture on it, but wonder, is it really important? After all, the war lasted only 10 weeks. I think John Hay, was the Secretary of State, said it was a splendid little war. Well, regardless how splendid it was a very little war. So we wonder, why devote time to this war? And I think the answer is that the war raises an important issue. And this issue came out very well in the one of the essays I asked you to read for this week, the famous essay by William Graham Sumner, the great American sociologist and economist, called The Conquest of the United States by Spain. And he felt that the Spanish-American War represented a departure from a traditional policy. He felt we were abandoning our belief, our belief in liberty and our republican institutions, republican not in the sense of political party, but meaning a kind of a somewhat libertarian institution, in favor of empire, just like Spain and the other European powers. So I want to address in this lecture, was he right about that? And we want to raise the question, did the Spanish-American War depart from our traditional American foreign policy? Of course, to ask that question, we first have to understand what is our traditional foreign policy. I want to first deal with a very interesting argument raised by Robert Kagan in a book that came out a few years ago called Dangerous Nation. Kagan was the starting off the first volume of a planned two-volume history of American foreign policy, and Kagan is a leading neoconservative, that's to say, someone who believes that the U.S. today should play a very active role in foreign policy, should not be just try to avoid war, but if necessary, go to war for various interests and to promote liberty as he conceives it. So what he said is no, the Spanish-American War did not depart from traditional American foreign policy. And what he says is, and this is, remember, he's trying to support his own views that the U.S. should have a very active interventionist foreign policy. He says, from the beginning of America's history, we've been a violent nation. We've always been an aggressive nation. We're not departing from our traditional policy at all. I see someone has a comment on sometimes that he says, I can hear that sometimes it's garbled. Well, that probably says I'm rather garbled myself. That's just scrambled brains, you see. So what is Kagan's evidence for his view that the it's always been a violent nation. Well, he points out during the 19th century, especially the middle of the 19th century, there was a doctrine called manifest destiny, which was the view that it's the destiny of America, the U.S., to expand across the whole continent of North America. Some people wanting to include Canada in that, but at least we would be, whether we did that or not, we would be going from the Atlantic across the whole Pacific. And so it was, according to this manifest destiny, it was the aim of the U.S. or the, our destiny to take over the whole continent. And in the Mexican War, which lasted from 1846 to 1848, showed that America was willing to use force to take over territory. We took over part from Mexico, a lot of Mexican territory, took over Texas, which the Texas territory includes New Mexico. And we took over California from them. So we were taking over a lot of territory. So came to the look. This shows that this 1898 wasn't such a departure from our traditional policy. We're always very aggressive. So what happened in the Spanish-American, he said, well, look, if you look at the Spanish-American War itself, we can see this continuity. Because what happened in the Spanish-American War? Well, remember, I'll just briefly, you know, there was a revolt that broke out in Cuba in 1895. Cuba was a Spanish colony, and they were revolting against the Spanish government. And then the U.S. Joined in the war to help the Cubans become independent, and afterwards Cuba became a virtual U.S. protectorate. It wasn't incorporated in the U.S., but it's really under U.S. control. So what Kagan and those who give us continuity argument say, well, look, this wasn't such a big departure because there were suggestions to take over Cuba that are very common in the 19th century in America. And there were, for example, there were some Southerners who said, well, it would be a very good idea to extend slavery over there. They had slavery, so why not bring some of the Southern slaves over there? This would be a way of extending slavery. So there were a lot of suggestions by people to take over Cuba. And putting this in a more general frame, there was a famous doctrine, one of the most important policy statements of American policy in the 19th century, the Monroe Doctrine, which President Monroe stated in 1823, that seemed to say Latin America was our sphere of influence, that we would be in control, we should be in control of what happens in Latin America. So according to this argument, look, when the U.S. said, well, we're going to intervene in Cuba, they're not breaking with precedent. They're just following what Monroe Doctrine says, because Monroe Doctrine says, look, it's up to us what happens in Latin America. We're the dominant power, so we can intervene there. Now, Kagan goes on to add, he said another element of continuity is that America has always had an idealistic strain in its foreign policy. For example, in the 19th century, Americans sympathized with the Greek independence in the 1820s. The Greeks were part of the Ottoman, the Turkish Empire, and they were trying to become independent. So there was a lot of sympathy in the U.S. for them. And then in 1848, the Hungarians revolted against the Austrian Empire. They were part of the Austrian Empire. They revolted, and the leader of the Hungarian Revolution, Louis Kossuth, made a tour of the U.S. and was very favorably received. So Kagan said, look, America's policy in the Spanish-American War continued this idealistic emphasis because the Cuban people were being treated very harshly by the Spanish in the war, and I'm going to get into this when I start talking about the actual events leading up to the war. So what Kagan says is the U.S. was continuing its sympathy for trying to get freedom for other people just beyond the 19th century. So Kagan's really giving two arguments, that the U.S. was always expansionist, and plus the U.S. was idealistic. So he's saying, look, you shouldn't say that the Spanish-American War was a break in continuity with previous policy, but continuing our traditional policy. But I'll be arguing, that Kagan's thesis is wrong, and that the Spanish-American War did break with traditional American policy. So in order to make that argument, we need to do first to say, well, what was traditional American foreign policy? And the canonical statement of traditional American foreign policy is found in Washington's farewell address. Now, one thing a bit deceptive about this, you might think from the title farewell address, it was a speech that George Washington gave. But it wasn't. It was just an article published in a newspaper, the American Daily Advertiser, 1796, toward the end of Washington's second term in office when he was getting ready to leave. So this became really the basis for American foreign policy. And the key part of the address for our purposes is this. And I'll be just reading this kind of long quotation. I think it's important to give. He said, the great rule of conduct for us in regard to foreign nations is in extending our commercial relations to have with them as little political connection as possible. So he said, well, we want to have trade with all these foreign nations, but not to be politically involved with them. He said, so far as we have already formed engagement, as we've made alliances, let them be fulfilled with perfect good faith. So if we have treaties with various foreign nations, we shouldn't just say, well, we're going to break them because we don't want to get involved with anybody. He says, here let us stop, meaning let's not make any more such alliances. He says, Europe has a set of primary interests which to us have none, for a very remote relation. That's a bit unusual sense when he says, have a set of primary interests which to us have none. He means we don't have any concern with their primary interests. They're not our interests, at least. We have only a very remote relation to them. And then he goes on, hence she, meaning Europe, must be engaged in frequent controversies, the causes of which are essentially foreign to our concern. Hence, therefore, it must be unwise in us to implicate ourselves by artificial ties in the ordinary vicissitudes of our politics or the ordinary combinations and collisions of our friendships or enmity. Writing in a kind of formal way, just we shouldn't get involved in what the Europeans are doing. They have different concerns to ours. And he goes on, he said, our detached and distant situation, by that I mean, we're separated from Europe by the Atlantic Ocean, which isn't so easy to cross. Even now it isn't easy to cross if you're going to invade. One of the leading foreign policy scholars today, John Mearsheimer, has a famous phrase, the stopping power of water. So he's reiterating what Washington is saying, that our detached and distant situation invites and enables us to pursue a different course. If we remain one people under an efficient government, the period is not far off when we may define material injury from external annoyance. When we may take such an attitude as will cause the neutrality we may at any time resolve upon to be scrupulously respected, when belligerent nations, under the impossibility of making acquisitions upon us, will not lightly hazard the giving us provocation, when we may choose peace of war as our interest guided by justice shall counsel. They said, well, if we can keep apart from these European power politics, we can build ourselves up to such a point that no nation will be able to challenge us. Remember, America, when he was writing something, he was saying we're a very weak nation. But he's saying, because we're isolated from Europe, we can build ourselves up, and then we don't have anything to worry about. But now, finally, to end this long quotation, he says, why forgo the advantages of peculiar situation? He says, look, we're doing, we have this great advantage, we're isolated from other nations. Why quit our own to stand upon foreign ground? Why, by intervening our destiny with that of any part of Europe, entangle our peace and prosperity in the toils of European ambition, rivalship, interest, humor, and caprice? So he's saying, look, let's not get involved. Now you notice he says, use the phrase entangle. He doesn't speak of entangling alliances. That's the phrase from Jefferson's first inaugural. People sometimes mix that up. But he does use the word entangle in this farewell address. Now, you might think, but what I spend so much time about talking about the farewell address, because it doesn't say anything, have anything to do with the Spanish-American War. It doesn't say anything about going to war over Cuba, just as we shouldn't get involved in European power politics. So why did I bring it up? The key point is that the address says we'll avoid involvement in European power politics. We're not going to attempt to become a world power. We're just going to be confined to what goes on in our own country. We're not going to get in rivalries with the other European countries. And until 1898, we followed this policy. We didn't get involved in conflicts with the European powers. I mentioned before, Kagan talked about American sympathy for the Greek Rebellion in the 1820s and the Hungarian Revolution of 1848-49, but we didn't. Even though a lot of people in America were sympathetic to the Greeks or the Hungarians, we never did get involved. We didn't say we could be sympathetic to various developments. We didn't send troops over there. And I see someone has put on the comment, maybe we should take Washington advice when dealing with Iran. I think that would be a very good idea. So what Washington would say, look, let's going over there, we may have certain sympathies for various sides, but we shouldn't really get involved. So the Spanish-American War broke with Washington's principle because the U.S., especially when the U.S. took over the Philippines, which was part of, I'll be getting into this, how they did this, was part of the Spanish-American War. The U.S. was involved in imperialistic rivalries with the European powers. In Europe, beginning in 1870, there was the kind of European nations were all trying to add colonies to their territories, and there was a struggle for dominance over Africa and Asia, and the U.S. in this war got into that, so they were getting involved in struggles, these kind of European-style struggles, contrary to the mandate of the farewell address. There was a break with our traditional policy, contrary to what Kagan suggested. Now, I said that the U.S. followed this policy of non-intervention of European power politics throughout the 19th century up to this, what we're talking about today, the Spanish-American War. But you might say, well, look, isn't there a big exception then? What about the War of 1812? This isn't the war that I gave a lecture on this card, but you remember the War of 1812? The U.S. went to war with Britain. We claimed the British were interfering with our neutral rights. Remember, Britain was in a big war with France. France was under Napoleon. The British were the big enemies of Napoleon. There was a world war going on. So we claimed the U.S. was violating our rights. They were interfering with our trade, and they were taking sailors from our ship and saying they were really British subjects. And also, there were a lot of people in the U.S. who wanted to conquer Canada. They said, we have a good chance of taking over Canada from Britain. So you could say, well, isn't the U.S. then getting involved in a war with the British? I see somebody said Ron Paul on CNBC. Well, you shouldn't say that because then people start rushing out of my lecture to hear it. I'm tempted to do that myself. And I'm not going to do that because then I wouldn't get paid. So I'm not going to do that. So, so the objection is, well, wasn't America then involved in a European power conflict, contrary to what Farewell just said? But you see, this was the War of 1812 was not an attempt to intervene in European politics. We weren't saying we're going to get involved on the French side in the Napoleonic Wars. It was just development. We were just interested in what was going on in America. And it was never part of the Farewell Address or traditional policy that we would be follow pacifist policy in America, which I think we don't want to get involved in Europe. We don't want to get involved in world power politics. It might have been a very good idea if they'd been pacifist in America itself, but the key point was they don't want to get involved in wars in Europe. The War of 1812 wasn't an exception to that. Now, Kagan, knows this traditional interpretation and rejects that, well, what did he do with the Farewell Address? He's kind of been, seems like he's in big trouble. So he said, well, Washington just intended his policy of isolation from European power politics to be temporary. His idea is America would stay out of world politics until it became stronger, and then we would just become a more traditional nation like the European powers and start intervening. That's an interesting idea, but that isn't what Washington says at all. So I think it's clear the Farewell Address does say we're not going to be involved in European power politics. To the extent the War of 1898 got us involved in the imperialist rivalries with the other European powers, it was a break in traditional policy. Now, those who supported the war at the time appealed to another famous guideline for American foreign policy that I've already mentioned, the Monroe Doctrine. This was a speech by President James Monroe in 1823. The speech was really written by the Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams. Remember, John Quincy Adams was the son of a president, John Adams, and he himself became president later on. So, according to people who refer to Monroe Doctrine, they say Monroe Doctrine established that the U.S. was the dominant power in the Americas. It said that if Europeans were no longer free to colonize in the Americas. And by something I called the Polk Corollary, which was 1845, made this even clearer. This is referring to a statement by President James K. Polk. And he said that considerations of the European balance of power have no application to the American. So he's saying it's up to America to decide what goes on in Latin America. The European powers don't have any say in this, so we have the right then, according to this view, to tell the Spanish, look, what you're doing in Cuba isn't right, we're going to take over. And what Polk was responding to, remember when Texas became independent from Mexico, there was some movement in Texas to join the U.S. So the French government at the time said it would be good if if Texas remained independent and didn't join the U.S. So Polk is saying to the French, look, mind your own business. You have nothing to say about this. Now, again, I think this argument isn't right either. We can't say the Monroe Doctrine really shows that the Spanish-American War was in accord with traditional American policy, because the Monroe Doctrine did not apply to European colonies that already existed in 1823, and Cuba was one of the oldest Spanish colonies, so it couldn't really be invoked to demand Cuban independence, because all that the Monroe Doctrine said was that Latin America is no longer open to European colonization. So it doesn't say we're going to overthrow all the existing European colonies. It just says you can't make any new colonies. And in return, Monroe reaffirmed that the U.S. didn't want any involvement in European political struggle. So to the extent that the Spanish-American War did get us involved in European struggles, it wouldn't be in accord with the Monroe Doctrine either. So what I've said so far is the Monroe Doctrine really broke with the principle of the Spanish-American War really broke with the principle of the farewell address, and also broke with the Monroe Doctrine. So it was a big shift in American foreign policy. Now, I've now tried to show the war was a big shift, but we want to know now, well, what were the actual details of the war? So what we have to realize first is, although Cuba had been a colony of Spain for a long time, increasingly in the 19th century, a lot of the Cubans were very dissatisfied with Spanish rule over them. In particular, there had been a 10-year war for independence in Cuba that ended unsuccessfully in 1878. There was a war 1868-1878 in Cuba where there was a movement in Cuba trying to become independent. Now, what did they have? What were their grievances against the Spanish? Well, they thought that a lot of the profits from their agriculture, their sugar production, other things that were going on there, were going to the Spanish government. The Cubans weren't getting a benefit from this, or enough benefit. And also, there was a lot of preference for Spaniards as opposed to native Cubans. They thought there was discrimination against native Cubans, and there's too much preference for the Spanish. And there was also slavery in Cuba. The black slaves were very dissatisfied. Slavery was eventually abolished in 1886. But there were still the Afro-Cubans were very discriminated against. Now, I see someone has asked, is Kagan a source of authority for the neocons? Yes, he is. He'd be regarded as one of their principal foreign policy experts. Now, some of the people in the Cuban independence movement favored closer ties with the U.S. Some people said, well, the Cuban trade is, the U.S. is playing an increasingly important part in Cuban trade, so we should get more closely involved with the U.S. and not so much with Spain anymore. We should turn more to the U.S. But other Cubans said, no, we should become independent, not only of Spain, but the U.S. as well. And there were some Americans, such as James G. Blaine, who was the Secretary of State under three different administrations. James Garfield, remember the one who was assassinated, Chester Arthur just for 4 months, and then Benjamin Harrison. So he wasn't Secretary of State, and then after Chester Arthur, then Grover Cleveland was elected for one term, that he was defeated by Benjamin Harrison, so he was Secretary of State, and he favored annexation of Cuba. He thought Cuba should become an American part of American territory. Remember, Blaine was the one, he ran for president himself, he was running for the Republican nomination. He inspired the famous slogan, Blaine, Blaine, continental liar from the state of Maine. But he wasn't the only one who favored annexation of Cuba. There were people at the time, influential people who did. So, as I say, there was a revolt that had ended in 1878. Now, there was a new revolt that broke out in 1895. And this was led by Jose Marti. There should be an accent over the I, but I didn't know how to put this on the slide. I don't think I have the right letters for it on the slide, on my typing for the slide. There should be an accent. He was a very noted writer. And on the military side, the military leader was Maximo Gomez. So he was a very good military leader. He'd been involved in the war that ended in 1878 also. So he was a military leader. And also a rather unusual character who was a Polish, half-Polish, half-Cuban military man who had lived in the U.S. was General Carlos Roloff. He was also important. So what this rebellion aimed to do was similar to the earlier one, wanted to end the dominance of the planter class. And there were great sugar plantations in Cuba. So this rebellion said the planter class is too powerful, and they wanted to promote equality for blacks. So Jose Marti was also opposed to U.S. dominance. He said, no, we shouldn't just get rid of the Spanish and then try to put the U.S. in. We should be just an independent nation. But he was killed in battle in 1895. Now, how did the Spanish react to this revolt? Well, they weren't, it's my guess, they weren't very favorable to it. Spain didn't regard Cuba as just some sort of outlying possession. They thought Cuba was integral to the Spanish Empire. In fact, they didn't regard it as a colony. They thought of it as part of Spain itself. If some of you are familiar with the revolt of Algeria against France in the 20th century, similar, Algeria was considered not a colony of France, but a constituent part of France. It was one of the Algerians counted as French citizens. So similarly, Spain said Cuba is not just some colony we can just get rid of because the Cubans don't want us around anymore. It's part of Spain itself. And the prime minister of Spain at the time of the rebellion was a rather tough character named Antonio Canovas del Castillo. He was prime minister of Spain for a good deal of the later 19th century. He was a very noted conservative, and he played a main role in the restoration of the Bourbon dynasty to rule in Spain. Remember, the Bourbons were the Spanish rulers, and they were expelled by Napoleon had put in his own family, but the Bourbons came back after Napoleon was defeated, and there were various wars that took place by various factions in Spain. Canovas del Castillo was one of the principal ones defending this Bourbon dynasty. So what's important for our purposes on the war is he thought that for Spain to continue as an important power in Europe, it was essential that Spain retain some of its foreign territories. So he couldn't just say, well, okay, the Cubans don't like us anymore, so maybe we can reach some kind of settlement with them and let them become independent. He thought, no, we really have to keep Cuba in the Spanish Empire. We don't want them becoming independent. We'll lose a lot of prestige if we were to surrender to the revolt. So he's very anxious to end the revolt. Now, the first person who was sent over as the general in command, his name Arsenio Martinez de Campos, and he had been the victor of the 1878 war. So what his strategy was in coping with the rebels, see, the rebels were not, didn't really raise a big army, they just were kind of a guerrilla movement. And so what he says is, well, we can confine them to the eastern provinces of Cuba, kind of build a big ditch across Cuba, kind of prevent them from going anywhere other than where they are. So we wanted to say, well, we're going to confine we're going to confine the revolt to one area. So Canovas del Castillo wasn't satisfied with it, because then other areas that he wasn't weren't covered by this line would still be subject to revolt, and this included Havana and other wealthy areas. So what Canovas was saying to Martinez de Campos was, look, you may have confined the revolt to a certain area of Cuba, but you've left unprotected, not very protected very much, some essential elements of Cuba, some of the most important territories you're leaving subject to revolt, so you're not going to last anymore. And so Canovas replaced Campos with someone else was called, a new general is called Valeriano Weyler. Now, I'm not sure the pronunciation of the last name, the W sound in Spanish, if you have W's in Spanish, it's hard to tell how they're pronounced, but it's usually taken over from a foreign word, so I may be mispronouncing the name, but I think this is correct. And from his nickname, you'll see that Weyler wasn't too popular. He was called Butcher Weyler. What his strategy was different from Campos. Campos said, well, we're going to confine the revolt to a certain part of Cuba. But Weyler said, what we're going to do to prevent these guerrilla fighters from having contact with the Cuban peasants and the rural people, we're going to force all the rural people into concentration camps. This is called the policy of reconcentration. And more than 300,000 people were forced into these camps, and thousands of them died. So he was on a very brutal policy. Now, he wasn't the originator of the concentration camp. It was really the British who had started them when they were having the Boer War, when the South African against the Dutch settlers who revolted them. The British used concentration camps to an even greater extent than Weyler did in Cuba. Incidentally, I didn't put this in the slide, but one of the people attached to the Cuban army as a British observer was Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill was there in 1897. In Cuba, he was around for the Spanish-American War. You know, we think of Churchill World War I, World War II, but he was around for the Spanish-American War too. Now, I think it's interesting to note that when we said, how did Rayler get to be so tough? What gave him these ideas? Well, he was influenced in his attitude toward war by the American general, William Tecumseh Sherman, the famous general in the war between the states, who had the march to Georgia, where he just destroyed all, burned a lot of land and crops and burned various cities. Rayler had been, he was influenced by General Sherman. He had a lot of contact with the American Army, because in his earlier years he'd been an attaché, a military attaché at the Spanish embassy in Washington. So he was very much influenced by some of the Union generals, in particular Sherman, their very ruthless attitude toward conducting war, where you can take action against the civilians. My slide didn't shift yet. Let's try it again. Ah, here we go. Now, Rayler's policies were very effective. He was succeeding in countering the Cuban revolt, but it roused a lot of angry protest in the U.S. And the campaign against Rayler was led by two rival New York newspaper owners, William Randolph Hearst and Joseph Pulitzer. Hearst, when some of you may have been to California, may have seen the famous Hearst Castle. It was a mansion that he built. That was the same person. And Pulitzer is the one where we have the Pulitzer Prizes were named after him. But both of these newspaper owners were trying to raise the circulation of their papers to as much a great degree as possible. And they engaged in very lurid accounts of Spanish atrocities, because reading about these atrocities would get a lot of attention. If someone points out, Ryan points out, that's called yellow journalism. They called it yellow journalism because a cartoon character in Pulitzer's paper, The New York World, is called the Yellow Kid. So that's where the phrase yellow journalism comes from. So these papers by Hearst and Pulitzer were really painting Spanish in a very bad way, and they sometimes made up stories. They were urging wars. And why'd they do that? Well, this was a way of promoting the circulation of their newspapers. They would say, this is a good way we can get a lot of people buy our paper, just start to get a war scare started, because then people start buying our paper. So they were very avid for war. Now, to return to a point I made earlier in the lecture, beginning in the 1870s, there was a vast expansion of European empire building. England led the way with, they were taking over, going, extending their conquests from India into Afghanistan, elsewhere. They were going into China and other parts of Asia. So England was really the leader in expanding, trying to take colonies, and France wasn't far behind. Italy and Germany were also involved, although not to as great an extent. Now, when this was going on, when we had this rise of European imperialism, there were some very influential Americans who thought that the U.S. should get involved in empire building as well. So Murray Rothbard pointed out that there were some businessmen who thought that colonies would offer a market for American goods. So some businessmen thought that there was a problem with capitalism. They said, well, we need to, capitalism will produce too much. People won't, in America, won't be able to buy all the goods that the American producers make, so we need to find new markets, and one way to get those would be to have more colonies. So what Roth is really kind of anticipating kind of a Marxist view of imperialism. And Roth, I find out that there were American businessmen who anticipated this. They said, well, we need to have colonies to have a market for our goods. Of course, it's bad economics, but that didn't stop them from advocating it. Now, two very influential Americans who favored imperialism and were very involved in the drive toward war with Spain over Cuba were Senator Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts and Theodore Roosevelt of New York. He wasn't the senator, he had been the governor of New York. He and Lodge were very close friends. And both Lodge and Roosevelt were very strong advocates of going to war with Spain. Now, Lodge was influenced by racial theories. You know, of course, now race is a very politically incorrect idea, but at that time, racial theories were very much in the air. And Lodge had the view that the Anglo-Saxon race, we wouldn't call the race now in the biological sense, but he would talk about the Anglo-Saxon race, meaning the people in America and England. He said, this race is rising. The Anglo-Saxon race is going to take over. And the Latin race, like the Spaniards and the French, were on the Italian, were going down. They were declining. So Lodge said, well, look, it's just part of the trend of history that we should take over Cuba because Cuba belongs to declining Spanish power and America is part of the rising Anglo-Saxon race. Now, Theodore Roosevelt was influenced by the famous theorist of naval power, Admiral Alfred Thayer Mahan. Mahan was, I think at the time he wrote a famous book, he was then the captain, but he was promoted eventually to admiral. He wrote a book called The Influence of Sea Power Upon History, 1660-1683. What Mahan did, he was here applying some ideas that the great historian of Rome, Theodore Mommsen, had used when he was talking about the rise of Rome. What Mahan was trying to do was they powdered Britain, which was a small island, become kind of dominant power in the world. But he stresses the role of sea power in building up British power. So Mahan said, the nation wants to become great, it has to have a powerful navy. Having a powerful navy would be one way a nation could increase its strength. So Theodore Roosevelt, which knew Mahan, he was very influenced by him, and he agreed with him that sea power was essential to national greatness. And one thing Mahan pointed out was, if a nation wanted to become a great sea power, then it had to have control naval bases all over the world in certain strategic locations. He said the British had done that. If you want to have a strong navy, you need to control these naval bases. So, as we'll see in the war itself, Theodore Roosevelt was very anxious to seize Manila Bay in the Philippines, and the reason he wanted to do that was he was following what Mahan had said: we need to have this as a naval base so we can build up the American sea power. So this is one reason that he was favoring war. So we have for say some newspaper propaganda, Hearst and Pulitzer, then we have these intellectuals or in politics, Henry Cabot Lodge and Theodore Roosevelt. They're both very smart, but they had unusual theory. Henry Cabot Lodge believed in a racial theory where the Anglo-Saxon race was coming up, the Latin race was declining, and Roosevelt was a follower of Alfred Thayer Mahan. He said we have to build up the American Navy sea power, and having a war with Spain would be one way to do that. Now, despite these forces for war, the outbreak of war was by no means inevitable. First of all, General Whaler, who was the butcher Whaler that everybody hated, people say he was rightly very oppressive to the Cubans, he was replaced in 1897. And also, the conservative economist Del Castillo, who was the one who said, look, we need to keep Cuba in the Spanish Empire, this is essential to Spanish greatness. He was assassinated, and that didn't do much for his further political career, assassination, where they say, death is just nature's way of telling you to slow down. So he was replaced. The new prime minister was Praxedes Sagasta. Now, Sagasta was, if you look at the history of Spain in the late 19th century, there was an alternation between Canovas and Sagasta prime ministers, and Sagasta was more liberal than Canovas. So when Sagasta was in power, there were much better prospects for peace than if Canovas had remained. So, but the U.S. was kept sending the Spanish notes and demanding that they treat the Cubans better. So the Spanish seemed willing to negotiate, but they tended to drag their feet. They weren't doing very much, but they didn't reject what the Americans were asking for either. So there seemed to be some prospects for peace. They said, well, maybe the Spanish can agree to go easier on the Cubans, they can reach some kind of peaceful settlement with the independence movement, especially under this new liberal government of Sagasta. So we don't need to have a war with them. A new slide. Why doesn't the slide change? We're having a bit of a problem here. I like the slides to change when I, oh, here we go. Now, the President of the United States at the time was William McKinley. And he had been a general in the Union Army, and because he'd been involved in a very bloody war, he was reluctant to get involved in a new war. So this would be an additional reason for thinking maybe there can be some peaceful settlement, that we don't have to get involved in war. But then there was some trouble that happened. There were two things that caused trouble, two incidents caused trouble. First of all, in January 1898, the battleship USS Maine was sent from Florida to Havana Harbor to protect American interests. So the Spanish weren't very happy about this. You can imagine, say, we were in a struggle with Mexico is an extremely powerful nation. Say they send us a big battleship to the port of New York, we wouldn't be very happy about it. So the Spanish weren't too happy to see the American battleship, but that they didn't really do anything about it. It was just there. Now then, on February 9th, 1898, the New York Journal, which was William Randolph Hearst's policy. Well, I see there's a question here. When I was talking about the Canovas and Sagasta, I said, called them liberal and conservative. I mean, in the modern sense, Well, liberal would mean more like classical liberal, and conservative would be more in favor of the monarchy and aristocracy, so it'd be somewhat different from how they're used today. That was an excellent question. I should have gone into that. Okay, so February 19, 1898, New York Journal published a letter from the Spanish minister to Washington, named Enrique Dupuy de Lome. They call him minister, see, some nations didn't have ambassadors, they could have ministers, and that depends on if they're somewhat lower rank than ambassador, but it's the equivalent of ambassador. So they published this letter. He didn't intend it to be public, but the paper published anyway. It referred to McKinley in disparaging terms. It said McKinley, the weak person, the mother kind of person would bow with the wind. Now that was perfectly true. McKinley was kind of a weak person, but naturally, being McKinley, the American public would be very happy about seeing the Spanish minister describe McKinley, the president, in that way. And he, Jerome, immediately resigned and went back to Spain, but the damage had been done by publication of this letter. Now, the most famous incident was shortly after the Jerome letter, kind of a 1-2 punch. In February 15, 1898, the Maine, which you remember was in the harbor of Havana, blew up. Now, the Hearst and Pulitzer papers immediately claimed the Spanish did it, but this has never been proved. It seems unlikely the Spanish would do it because it would be very much against their interests to provoke trouble with the U.S., but the battleship did blow up and many people were killed. So in response to that, McKinley sent a note to the Spanish in March 1898 demanding that they suspend hostilities in Cuba, and he threatened war if they didn't do it. So he said, look, this battle against the Cubans has gone far enough, you'd better stop hostilities. If you don't, we're going to declare war against you. And then in April, the Spanish seemed not to have done much in response to McKinley's note. They were kind of temporizing. McKinley asked Congress for a declaration of war because he said the Spanish hadn't met his demand. The very odd thing about McKinley's speech, he had to admit, and he put this in kind of the last few lines of his speech, that the Spanish really did seem to accept his demands at the last minute. They'd send a message that they really accepted his demand, but he asked for war anyway. And this is a quotation he had. He said, yesterday, and since the preparation of the foregoing message, and since he wrote his speech, official information was received by me, the latest decree of the Queen Regent of Spain. See, at that time, the King of Spain was Alfonso, then Alfonso XII, and he died, but his son, Alfonso XIII, was too young to become king, so it was a regency under the Queen Maria Cristina, who was Austria. So he said, the latest decree of Queen Regent of Spain directs General Blanco, he was the general who had replaced Weyler, in order to prepare and facilitate peace, to proclaim a suspension of hostility, duration and details of which have not yet been communicated to me. So what he's saying there is, looks like the Spanish accepted his demand, but he's asking for war anyway. So it's funny to just throw this in at the end. And then war was declared. They ignored the fact the Spanish had accepted the terms. Now, what Kagan says about that, he says, well, they were justified in going to war because the Spanish acceptance wasn't that forthright, but it certainly seems like they were accepting the demand. once the war started, Theodore Roosevelt, who was the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, directed Admiral Thomas Dewey to seize Manila Harbor. Remember, Roosevelt wanted to build up the American Navy, so he said, we need to have Manila Harbor. Now, the way he was able to do this was that the Secretary of the Navy, named John Long, was not so warlike, but he happened to be out of the office, so Roosevelt said, well, I'm in charge now, I'm sending this order, and then it was too late to do anything once Long came back, because Dewey'd already gone into action. Now, when the Americans went into the Philippines, they first, there was a Philippine independence movement. The Philippines was a Spanish colony also. So there was a Philippine independence movement led by Aguinaldo, who was the Philippine leader. And first, the Americans cooperated with them, but later, after the victory of the Spanish, they wouldn't turn over to the government, to the Filipinos. And there was a lengthy guerrilla war against the Filipinos. So we started off, we're saying, well, we're getting into this war, we want to free the Cubans from Spanish tyranny, even though the Spaniards had agreed to suspend hostilities. But now we're taking over the Philippines, we're saying we're not going to let the Filipinos be independent. And in this guerrilla war that was going on for a long time, the Theodore Roosevelt had become president, declared the Philippines passed by 1902, but there was a lot of fighting after that. It was into the fight Philippines. The Americans conducted this war in a very brutal fashion. There were many people were killed and tortured. Remember in the Iraq War, people were talking about waterboarding. This was used in the war in the Philippines. It was considered a form of torture, and it was one of the things that was used. So America had been abandoned our traditional non-interventionist policy, and we've been involved in imperialist rivalries with the European powers, under these new ideas of they're favored by Roosevelt Lodge and others in America. So I think that this will end the lecture now, and then we'll now go to the Q&A box. If you have questions or objections, comments, I'll try to answer them if I can. Okay, so here's the first one. Do you think Teddy Roosevelt would have been president without the Spanish-American War? Well, I think he would, because remember what had happened was he'd been selected as vice president for McKinley in 1896 because he was he'd been governor of New York. He was considered kind of a reformed figure in New York. So a lot of the figures who didn't like his reforms said, well, we can make him vice president because vice president is a nice office that doesn't have any real power. So he's kind of being kicked upstairs. So he would have become president because McKinley was assassinated. So even if there had been no Spanish-American War, he would, as long as he had still been picked as vice president, which he was before the war, he would have become president. Now, Peter says, in Manifest Destiny, contradict Jeffersonian thought. Jefferson didn't want to become entangled with foreign affairs, but what for states becoming independent support the French Revolution? Well, you're perfectly right. Jefferson didn't want to become entangled in foreign affairs and want an independent state. But he did also favor territorial expansion of America. Remember, he was the one who made the Louisiana Purchase from Napoleon. And he thought that if there was expansion across America, it might not result in a single American country. There might be various countries before now the territory, but he didn't use the phrase manifest destiny, but he did favor American territorial expansion. Now, Peter said, did Hearst and Pulitzer claim Spain blew up the main Castell newspaper? They had no facts, correct? Well, there was a report that had been conducted by the American Navy that claimed that a mine had blown up the ship, and then the Spanish conducted their own investigation and said, no, it was something, it was just something that had gone wrong on the ship. It had started a fire. But they had no evidence at all that the Spanish were involved in this. That's right, they were just trying to. They thought they wanted a war, and they thought this would be a way of building up their circulation of their paper. So they said, well, look, the Spanish have blown up our battleship, now we have to go to war. I think someone remembers the name. But you're right, they didn't have any basis for saying that. They really didn't make up the whole thing. Now, I would say this isn't directly relevant to that. I know Rothbard is very interested in the designation of U.S. president. Since you mentioned McKinley, what were Rothbard's thought on McKinley's assassination? Well, I don't think he had any distinctive view of McKinley's assassination or any special conspiracy theory. One kind of interesting point on McKinley's assassination is McKinley didn't die of the bullet wound that inflicted on him by laying on Solco. He actually died of gangrene poisoning. If it happened under modern conditions, he probably could have been saved. He died under because of gangrene poisoning. Justin said, I remember Rothbard thought the Rockefeller interest was one of the primary causes of war. Am I remembering correctly? I think Rothbard thought that Rockefeller interests were very important later on in American history. I don't think he thought they were responsible for Spanish-American War. I mean, even the Morgan interests, who were very powerful, more powerful than Rockefeller at this time, I don't think he blamed them for the war. There were Morgan people that he wrote about who favored this view that we need colonies and imperialist expansion to the market for American goods, so they may have favored the war. I don't think he thought they were principally involved in the immediate events leading up to the war, but I'd have to look into that to be sure. Ivanson, what do you think Washington has thought of the Monroe Doctrine? That's a very interesting point. Frank Chodorov, I think, thought the Monroe Doctrine departed from Washington's farewell address because it was saying that we can intervene in Latin American countries. And Washington seems to be saying we shouldn't get involved in anything. We should just stay out of European power politics. Although, I suppose Washington view does leave it open to the Monroe Doctrine. It doesn't really say that we should get involved in colonies either. Now, it's interesting, one point on Monroe Doctrine, the 20th century legal theorist Carl Schmitt, one of the greatest German legal theorists, who for a while was a member of the Nazi Party, he said, look, the Monroe Doctrine, we can apply a similar idea to German foreign policy, because they just as the America's dominant power in Latin America, we say Germany should be the dominant power in Europe, so we can have kind of what he called a great space, a gross realm in Europe, just like the American sphere of influence in Latin America. So he's kind of applying the Monroe Doctrine to European affairs, suggested by German dominance. Ivan says, in one reading for some of the reviews says that sometimes state may take an area under its influence to civilize it. Couldn't this be used as an excuse for intervention anyway? This doesn't sound very non-interventionist to me. Well, I think you're right. That isn't a non-interventionist point, but I think Sumner is just saying that's one of the motives a state might have to engage in intervention. He doesn't think that it would be justified in doing it, but he just says that's one of the purposes a state might have in mind. You see, one thing to bear in mind, in the 19th century, there was a kind of different view to one of current. Now we tend to think, well, there are different kinds of civilizations, they're all different. But at that time, there was definitely a view that our civilization, European civilization, called white civilization, was on a higher level than others, that were primitive people that were really below us, and they needed to be civilized. In France, you had the phrase, the civilizing mission, mission civilatrice, and this was actually a motive in imperialism. I don't think some are saying, because of that, you're justified in taking over, but it was a view that's influential. Even John Stuart Mill in On Liberty says that he's generally saying that in favor of classical liberalism, he said, if despotism might be justified, it is a case of some nation trying to civilize some other nation to prepare them for liberty. Of course, Mill himself was an employee of the British East India Company, defended the British rule in India because they said they're civilizing the people there. Now, Brian says, was the Spanish American War, the start of newspapers and other forms of media, becoming a piece of government propaganda? Well, it wasn't the start, but it certainly intensified. And I mean, we find a war between states. We had all sorts of newspaper propaganda. Also, now I see the question in the chat. I'll just deal with it. Somebody says, what accounts for King's different interpretation of history from the years, I guess, in the 9th, as far as tonight's topic. Well, I think Kagan is a neoconservative. He's trying to come up with a justification for a neoconservative policy. So what he wants to do is think, look, we neoconservatives aren't breaking radically with traditional American foreign policy. We're in continuity with it. So I think that's really why he's taking this view, which I think goes contrary to the evidence. And now Matthew said, to clarify, you argue that the Spanish-American War was unique because it was predicated on a change in policy to a European power, and not because it was expansionist, right? Your slide didn't seem to match your point of contention with Kagan. Well, what I was trying to stress was it was expansionist outside of the American continent. That's what the difference with Kagan is. Kagan said, well, America was always expansionist, but I was saying it is just true in the across North America, but the expansionist part that changed policies, we were now engaged in imperialist rivalry with the European powers. So I think that's what the difference is. Sorry, I didn't make that clear. Progressives, Leslie said, progressives beat the drums for U.S. participation in World War I. Were they also in favor of the Spanish-American War? Not as much. There was, say, some of the people were progressive, like William James, the famous Harvard philosopher, and Atkinson were part of the anti-imperialist league. So you don't have, progressives were really a somewhat later move, and we'll be getting into them next week. So they weren't as much of a factor in the Spanish-American War as in World War One. Now, Brian says, have you written any articles or essays in response to Kagan's Dangerous Nation? I reviewed the book, not entirely favorably, in the American Conservative some years ago. I think that's available on their website. I don't know. I think you might have to have a subscription to get it, but if somebody wants it, I suppose I could try to get it for them. But Now, Justin says, why are Kagan and other neoconservatives obsessed with using precedent to justify their political views? Well, I think people have criticized and say, well, you're breaking with American tradition. You want to get us involved in all these wars just for your own purposes. You have these particular views that you favor and you want to get us involved. But so if the neoconservatives say, well, look, America's always been this way, they think that would lend them some support. They're saying, look, we're not breaking with American precedent. We're just following what the people in the 19th century did. We're in the American tradition. That's one way some revolutionaries say sometimes operate. Remember, in World War II, the American Communist Party said, well, we're just patriotic Americans, what they called the Communist Party School in New York, it's called the Jefferson School of Social Science. It was a traditional thing for people who were revolutionaries to say, well, we're really not so revolutionary, we're just continuing traditional points of view. And Matthew said, were mercantilist views still dominant view among the political elite, even late 19th century, with the classical school equally influential? Well, I think the view that was dominant wasn't strict mercantilist, but it wasn't a completely free enterprise point of view either. The view had certain mercantilist affinities in that it was saying we need to have the state really in control or interfering in the market, and say, in the case I mentioned, some of the businessmen thought getting securing markets for American good. It wasn't so much we have to as we have to pile up gold, but it was more we have to expand American markets and necessarily using the government to force other nations to give us these markets. So I think that would be a more dominant view. Now, Ray says, did the Spanish-American War set us up for future wars with Japan? Well, it did to the extent that we'd acquired territory in the Pacific, Guam and the Philippines, that were involved later in our conflict with Japan. Of course, we'd acquired Hawaii as part of an expansionist move. Also, Cleveland was against annexation of Hawaii, but they got it anyway. So I think to that extent it did set up us up for a war with Japan. Okay, well, we still have another few minutes. Now here's one from Peter. The colonization in the 17th century led to decentralization of government in the 18th century, led by the War of Independence. After the war between the states was fashionable to centralize, it's still that way today. Can we get back? Well, I just think that depends on what ideas people have. I don't think it's anything to determine whether we're going to be centralized or more decentralized, other than the ideas people have about it. So, I mean, I think if we want to be more decentralized, that really depends on us and trying to get to decentralized views and more libertarian views accepted by more people. I mean, what's the best book on the Spanish-American War in your opinion? Well, that's a good question. I think there's a book by Walter Millis that was very good, an older book. I think I forgot the exact title, but I could look that up. It's Millis, I'll put his name down here. Put this on the chat section. Did I put that in? Yes, Walter Millis. It's not Mills, but Millis. And you can look him up. You'll get the title of it right away. he was the one who said, remember I was talking about the Jerome letter, he was the one who said what Jerome said about McKinley was perfectly justified. But if you look that book up, it's very good. Early, it came out in the 1930s, it's still a very good book, so that would be a good one to look at. Someone, Chris, Men of Politics of War by Walsh. Yes, that's an excellent book. That's one of the best books that deals not just with the Spanish-American War, but World War One as well. That's an excellent book. I'll tell you a funny story about Walter Karp. I see he was very good on this period, but he wasn't a completely libertarian person. He was someone who believed sort of the old-style Republican virtue, not Republican Party, but kind of Republican in the sense of the Roman Republican people, that people should be virtuous. So one time I remember my friend Ronald Hanaway, who was editing for Inquiry magazine in 1979, called Karp up and wanted him to write an article. That time there were some writing an article opposing the military draft, and Hamaway has an extremely good at sarcastic delivery. You can say things in a very sarcastic way, and I remember him on the phone talking to him saying, "Oh, you're in favor of conscription," and that ended the talk of that article. But Karp's book is extremely good. Now, Justin asked, was Roosevelt a good military commander? Actually, he was involved in the Charge of San Juan Hill and other things. He wasn't one of the major figures, but he was pretty good in the tactical level. He wasn't one who was commanding the whole war, but he was a very brave person. He was well liked by his men, so he was pretty good. He was extremely intelligent also. My friend, late Mel Bradford, who was a great literary scholar in American history, actually rated Roosevelt the smartest of all the American presidents. That's an unusual view, but I mean, it's not really that outrageous. He was an extremely smart person. He was pretty good as the military commander. I'm glad that Chris mentions the Politics of War by Karp. That is a very good book. Now, Ivan said, I almost forgot to ask this. I heard you do a great impression of Hayek. Would you do your impression of him before time runs out? Well, I can. If you want that, I can try. You're just recovering from a cold. I don't know if I'll come out too well. But I remember when I was taking Hayek's class on philosophy and social science in 1969, that was a long time ago, he referred to a book by his friend Karl Popper, which he called The Logic of Research. So a student put up his hand and said, isn't the title of that book Logic of Scientific Discovery? So Hayek had a big smile on his face and said, you are quite right that when the book appeared in English translation in 1959, it was under the title The Logic of Scientific Discovery. But you see, when the book first appeared in Vienna in 1934, it was under the title Logik der Forschung, which translates the logic of research. A big smile on his face, that kind of shut that student up. You should just talk by NL time. Well, I'll take that under advice and I probably won't do it. Now, Brian asked how influential was Billy Ray Montgomery. Well, he was very influential. He was principally the most famous work. He was one of the great sociologists. He wrote a multi-volume work called Folkways. What his idea was, you know, my other course now we're talking about literature and ethics. So he had views on ethics. He thought ethics really consisted, there wasn't an objective ethics that consisted of social customs, what he called mores, M-O-R-E-S. And he wrote about this in the folk, multi-volume word, Folkways. So he was extremely influential. And then he was also considered one of the leading, he wrote a very good book, you should sure book called What Social Classes Owe to Each Other. It's one of the great libertarian classics of the 19th century. You have the famous phrase in it, the forgotten man. Roosevelt later misappropriated, Franklin Roosevelt later misappropriated, but he said somebody said something like, A and B get together to decide what C shall be made to do for D. I call C the forgotten man. So Sumner was one of the most important American sociologists. He was also an economic historian who wrote a history of American tariff. So he's one of the leading American, so pioneer American social sciences. Okay, we have a little bit more time, I think. Okay, any last question or two? Now, do you think Ron Paul was shot for GOP? Not. Well, I suppose it would be a very long shot. I mean, we can hope he gets it, but I mean, I tend to think he wouldn't, but his poll numbers would have to come up a lot. But I mean, maybe the people said, well, I hope the people said, well, the other candidates aren't very good. People will turn to him. I hope they do, but I don't think it seems all that likely, but you know, one can only hope. Do you think the war was related to the communist revolution in Cuba? Well, the Cuban communists looked to Jose Martí as one of their predecessors. In their interpretation of the 1898 war, the communists kind of stressed kind of the class struggle involved in the war. So they kind of looked to this war is a precedent for their own revolution. What they tended to stress was that they thought that the Cuban independence movement was doing pretty well without the U.S. So they said the U.S. really came in and got control of things that they thought the Cuban independence movement could have succeeded without the U.S. That's the communist interpretation of the Cuban, the 1895 Cuban rebellion. Well, I guess we're out of time now, unless anybody has any last questions. So thanks very much for coming to my lecture, and I hope we'll see you all next week when we're going to talk about World War I. I'll be giving you some of the revisionist historians like Harry Elmer Barnes, and I knew slightly when I was in high school, so I'll give you some stories about him. I can't do an imitation of him, but he didn't have such a special accent, but he was a very forceful person. I remember talking to him very well. So thanks, everybody, and hope to see you all next week.